Gimmicks 3 by Isaac Asimov. Come, come, said Shapur quite politely, considering that he was a demon. You are wasting my time. And your own, too, I might add, since you have only half an hour left. And his tail twitched. It's not dematerialization? Asked Isidore Welby thoughtfully. I have already said it is not, said Shapur. For the 100th time, Welby looked at the unbroken bronze that surrounded him on all sides. The demon had taken unholy pleasure, what other kind indeed, in pointing out that the floor, ceiling, and four walls were featureless 2-foot-thick slabs of bronze, welded seamlessly together. It was the ultimate locked room, and Welby had but another half hour to get out, while the demon watched with an expression of gathering anticipation. It had been 10 years previously, to the day, naturally, that Isidore Welby had signed up. We pay you in advance, said Shapur persuasively. 10 years of anything you want, within reason. And then you're a demon. You're one of us, with a new name of demonic potency, and many privileges beside. You'll hardly know you're damned. And if you don't sign, you may end up in the fire anyway, just in the ordinary course of things. You never know. Here, look at me. I'm not doing too badly. I signed up, had my 10 years, and here I am. Not bad. Why so anxious for me to sign, then, if I might be damned anyway? Asked Welby. It's not so easy to recruit Hell's Carder, said the demon, with a frank shrug that made the faint odor of sulfur dioxide in the air a trifle stronger. Everyone wishes to gamble on ending in heaven. It's a poor gamble, but there it is. I think you're too sensible for that. But meanwhile we have more damned souls than we know what to do with, and a growing shortage at the administrative end. Welby, having just left the army and finding himself with nothing much to show for it but a limp and a farewell letter from a girl he somehow still loved, pricked his finger and signed. Of course he read the small print first. A certain amount of demonic power would be deposited to his account upon signature in blood. He would not know in detail how one manipulated those powers, or even the nature of all of them, but he would nevertheless find his wishes fulfilled in such a way that they would seem to have come about through perfectly normal mechanisms. Naturally, no wish might be fulfilled which would interfere with the higher aims and purposes of human history. Welby had raised his eyebrows at that. Shapur coughed. A precaution imposed upon us by, above. You are reasonable. The limitation won't interfere with you. Welby said, there seems to be a catch clause, too. A kind of one, yes. After all, we have to check your aptitude for the position. It states, as you see, that you will be required to perform a task for us at the conclusion of your 10 years, one your demonic powers will make it quite possible for you to do. We can't tell you the nature of the task now, but you will have 10 years to study the nature of your powers. Look upon the whole thing as an entrance qualification. And if I don't pass the test, what then? In that case, said the demon, you will be only an ordinary damned soul after all. And because he was a demon, his eyes glowed smokily at the thought, and his clawed fingers twitched, as though he felt them already deep in the other's vitals. But he added suavely, come now, the test will be a simple one. We would rather have you as Carder than as just another chore on our hands. Welby, with sad thoughts of his unattainable loved one, cared little enough at that moment for what would happen after 10 years, and he signed. Yet the 10 years passed quickly enough. Isidore Welby was always reasonable, as the demon had predicted, and things worked well. Welby accepted a position, and because he was always at the right spot at the right time, and always said the right thing to the right man, he was quickly promoted to a position of great authority. Investments he made invariably paid off, and what was more gratifying still, his girl came back to him, most sincerely repentant, and most satisfactorily adoring. His marriage was a happy one, and was blessed with 4 children, 2 boys and 2 girls, all bright and reasonably well-behaved. At the end of 10 years, he was at the height of his authority, reputation, and wealth, while his wife, if anything, had grown more beautiful as she had matured. And 10 years, to the day, naturally, after the making of the compact, he woke to find himself not in his bedroom, but in a horrible bronze chamber of the most appalling solidity, with no company other than an eager demon. "You have only to get out, and you will be one of us," said Shapur. "It can be done fairly and logically by using your demonic powers, provided you know exactly what it is you're doing. You should by now." "My wife and children will be very disturbed at my disappearance," said Welby, with a beginning of regrets.
"They will find your dead body," said the demon consolingly. "You will seem to have died of a heart attack, and you will have a beautiful funeral. The minister will consign you to heaven, and we will not disillusion him or those who listen to him. Now come, Welby. You have till noon."
Welby, having unconsciously steeled himself for this moment for 10 years, was less panic-stricken than he might have been. He looked about speculatively. "Is this room perfectly enclosed? No trick openings?"
"No openings anywhere, in the walls, floor, or ceiling," said the demon, with a professional delight in his handiwork. "Or at the boundaries of any of those surfaces, for that matter. Are you giving up?"
"No, no, just give me time." Welby thought very hard. There seemed no sign of closeness in the room. There was even a feeling of moving air. The air might be entering the room by dematerializing across the walls. Perhaps the demon had entered by dematerialization, and perhaps Welby himself might leave in that manner. He asked. The demon grinned.
"Dematerialization is not one of your powers, nor did I myself use it in entering."
"You're sure now?"
"The room is my own creation," said the demon smugly, "and especially constructed for you."
"And you entered from outside?"
"I did."
"With reasonably demonic powers which I possess too?"
"Exactly. Come, let us be precise. You cannot move through matter, but you can move in any dimension by a mere effort of will. You can move up, down, right, left, obliquely, and so on, but you cannot move through matter in any way."
Welby kept on thinking, and Shapur kept on pointing out the utter immovable solidity of the bronze walls, floor, and ceiling, their unbroken ultimacy. It seemed obvious to Welby that Shapur, however much he might believe in the necessity for recruiting Carder, was barely restraining his demonic delight at possibly having an ordinary damned soul to amuse himself with. "At least," said Welby with a sorrowful attempt at philosophy, "I'll have 10 happy years to look back on. Surely that's a consolation, even for a damned soul in hell."
"Not at all," said the demon. "Hell would not be hell if you were allowed consolations. Everything anyone gains on earth by pacts with the devil, as in your case, or my own for that matter, is exactly what one might have gained without such a pact if one had worked industriously and in full trust in, above. That is what makes all such bargains so truly demonic."
And the demon laughed with a kind of cheerful howl. Welby said indignantly, "You mean my wife would have returned to me even if I had never signed your contract?"
"She might have," said Shapur. "Whatever happens is the will of, above, you know. We ourselves can do nothing to alter that."
The chagrin of that moment must have sharpened Welby's wits, for it was then that he vanished, leaving the room empty, except for a surprised demon. And surprise turned to absolute fury when the demon looked at the contract with Welby, which he had until that moment been holding in his hand for final action one way or the other. It was 10 years, to the day, naturally, after Isidore Welby had signed his pact with Shapur, that the demon entered Welby's office and said, most angrily, "Look here!" Welby looked up from his work, astonished. "Who are you?"
"You know very well who I am," said Shapur.
"Not at all," said Welby. The demon looked sharply at the man.
"I see you are telling the truth, but I can't make out the details."
He promptly flooded Welby's mind with the events of the last 10 years. Welby said, "Oh, yes, I can explain, of course, but are you sure we will not be interrupted?"
"We won't be," said the demon grimly.
"I sat in that closed bronze room," said Welby, "and..."
"Never mind that," said the demon hastily. "I want to know, please, let me tell this my way."
The demon clamped his jaws and fairly exuded sulfur dioxide, till Welby coughed and looked pained. Welby said,
"If you'll move off a bit..." "Thank you.
Now, I sat in that closed bronze room, and remembered how you kept stressing the absolute unbrokenness of the four walls, the floor, and the ceiling. I wondered, why did you specify? What else was there beside walls, floor, and ceiling? You had defined a completely enclosed three-dimensional space. And that was it, three-dimensional. The room was not closed in the fourth dimension. It did not exist indefinitely in the past. You said you had created it for me. So, if one traveled into the past, one would find oneself at a point in time eventually when the room did not exist, and then one would be out of the room. What's more, you had said I could move in any dimension, and time may certainly be viewed as a dimension. In any case, as soon as I decided to move toward the past, I found myself living backward at a tremendous rate, and suddenly there was no bronze around me anywhere. Shapur cried in anguish,
"I can guess all that. You couldn't have escaped any other way. It's this contract of yours that I'm concerned about. If you're not an ordinary damned soul, very well, it's part of the game. But you must be at least one of us, one of the Carder. It's what you were paid for. And if I don't deliver you down below, I will be in enormous trouble."
Welby shrugged his shoulders. "I'm sorry for you, of course, but I can't help you. You must have created the bronze room immediately after I placed my signature on the paper, for when I burst out of the room, I found myself just at the point of time at which I was making the bargain with you. There you were again. There I was. You were pushing the contract toward me, together with a stylus with which I might prick my finger. To be sure, as I had moved back in time, my memory of what was becoming the future faded out, but not apparently quite entirely. As you pushed the contract at me, I felt uneasy. I didn't quite remember the future, but I felt uneasy. So I didn't sign. I turned you down flat." Shapur ground his teeth.
"I might have known. If probability patterns affected demons, I would have shifted with you into this new if-world. As it is, all I can say is that you have lost the 10 happy years we paid you with. That is one consolation. And we'll get you in the end. That is another."
"Well now," said Welby, "are there consolations in hell? Through the 10 years I have now lived, I knew nothing of what I might have obtained. But now that you've put the memory of the 10 years that might have been into my mind, I recall that in the bronze room, you told me that demonic agreements could give nothing that could not be obtained by industry and trust in above. I have been industrious, and I have trusted." Welby's eyes fell upon the photograph of his beautiful wife and four beautiful children, then traveled about the tasteful luxuriance of his office. "And I may even escape hell altogether, That, too, is beyond your power to decide. And the demon, with a horrible shriek, vanished forever. Light Verse by Isaac Asimov. The very last person anyone would expect to be a murderer was Mrs. Avis Lardner. Widow of the great astronaut martyr, she was a philanthropist, an art collector, a hostess extraordinary, and everyone agreed, an artistic genius. But above all, she was the gentlest and kindest human being one could imagine. Her husband, William J. Lardner, died, as we all know, of the effects of radiation from a solar flare after he had deliberately remained in space so that a passenger vessel might make it safely to Space Station 5. Mrs. Lardner had received a generous pension for that, and she had then invested wisely and well. By late middle age, she was very wealthy. Her house was a showplace, a veritable museum, containing a small but extremely select collection of extraordinarily beautiful jeweled objects. From a dozen different cultures, she had obtained relics of almost every conceivable artifact that could be embedded with jewels and made to serve the aristocracy of that culture. She had one of the first jeweled wristwatches manufactured in America, a jeweled dagger from Cambodia, a jeweled pair of spectacles from Italy, and so on, almost endlessly. All was open for inspection. The artifacts were not insured, and there were no ordinary security provisions. There was no need for anything conventional, for Mrs. Lardner maintained a large staff of robot servants, all of whom could be relied on to guard every item with imperturbable concentration, irreproachable honesty, and irrevocable efficiency. Everyone knew the existence of those robots, and there is no record of any attempt at theft ever. And then, of course, there was her light sculpture. How Mrs. Lardner discovered her own genius at the art, no guest at her many lavish entertainments could guess. On each occasion, however, when her house was thrown open to guests, a new symphony of light shone throughout the rooms. Three-dimensional curves and solids in melting color, some pure and some fusing in startling crystalline effects that bathed every guest in wonder and somehow always adjusted itself so as to make Mrs. Lardner's blue-white hair and soft, unlined face gently beautiful. It was for the light sculpture more than anything else that the guests came. It was never the same twice, and never failed to explore new experimental avenues of art. Many people who could afford light consoles prepared light sculptures for amusement, but no one could approach Mrs. Lardner's expertise, not even those who considered themselves professional artists. She herself was charmingly modest about it. "No, no," she would protest when someone waxed lyrical. "I wouldn't call it poetry in light. That's far too kind. At most, I would say it was mere light verse." And everyone smiled at her gentle wit. Though she was often asked, she would never create light sculpture for any occasion but her own parties. "That would be commercialization," she said. She had no objection, however, to the preparation of elaborate holograms of her sculptures, so that they might be made permanent and reproduced in museums of art all over the world. Nor was there ever a charge for any use that might be made of her light sculptures. "I couldn't ask a penny," she said, spreading her arms wide. "It's free to all. After all, I have no further use for it myself." It was true. She never used the same light sculpture twice. When the holograms were taken, she was cooperation itself. Watching benignly at every step, she was always ready to order her robot servants to help. "Please, Courtney," she would say, "would you be so kind as to adjust the stepladder?" It was her fashion. She always addressed her robots with the most formal courtesy. Once, years before, she had been almost scolded by a government functionary from the Bureau of Robots and Mechanical Men. "You can't do that," he said severely. "It interferes with their efficiency. They are constructed to follow orders, and the more clearly you give those orders, the more efficiently they follow them. When you ask with elaborate politeness, it is difficult for them to understand that an order is being given. They react more slowly." Mrs. Lardner lifted her aristocratic head. "I do not ask for speed and efficiency," she said. "I ask goodwill. My robots love me." The government functionary might have explained that robots cannot love, but he withered under her hurt but gentle glance. It was notorious that Mrs. Lardner never even returned a robot to the factory for adjustment. Their positronic brains are enormously complex, and once in 10 times or so, the adjustment is not perfect as it leaves the factory. Sometimes the error does not show up for a period of time, but whenever it does, U.S. Robots and Mechanical Men Corporation always makes the adjustment free of charge. Mrs. Lardner shook her head. "Once a robot is in my house," she said, "and has performed his duties, any minor eccentricities must be borne with. I will not have him manhandled." It was the worst thing possible to try to explain that a robot was but a machine. She would say very stiffly, "Nothing that is as intelligent as a robot can ever be but a machine. I treat them as people." And that was that. She kept even Max, although he was almost helpless. He could scarcely understand what was expected of him. Mrs. Lardner denied that strenuously, however. "Not at all," she would say firmly. "He can take hats and coats and store them very well indeed. He can hold objects for me. He can do many things." "But why not have him adjusted?" asked a friend once. "Oh, I couldn't. He's himself. He's very lovable, you know. After all, a positronic brain is so complex that no one can ever tell in just what way it's off. If he were made perfectly normal, there would be no way to adjust him back to the lovability he now has. I won't give that up." "But if he's maladjusted," said the friend, looking at Max nervously, "might he not be dangerous?" "Never," laughed Mrs. Lardner. "I've had him for years. He's completely harmless and quite a dear." Actually, he looked like all the other robots, smooth, metallic, vaguely human, but expressionless. To the gentle Mrs. Lardner, however, they were all individual, all sweet, all lovable. It was the kind of woman she was. How could she commit murder? The very last person anyone would expect to be murdered would be John Semper Travis. Introverted and gentle, he was in the world, but not of it. He had that peculiar mathematical turn of mind that made it possible for him to work out in his mind the complicated tapestry of the myriad positronic brain pads in a robot's mind. He was chief engineer of U.S. Robots and Mechanical Men Corporation, but he was also an enthusiastic amateur in light sculpture. He had written a book on the subject, trying to show that the type of mathematics he used in working out positronic brain paths might be modified into a guide to the production of aesthetic light sculpture. His attempt at putting theory into practice was a dismal failure, however. The sculptures he himself produced, following his mathematical principles, were stodgy, mechanical, and uninteresting. It was the only reason for unhappiness in his quiet, introverted, and secure life, and yet it was reason enough for him to be very unhappy indeed. He knew his theories were right, yet he could not make them work. If he could but produce one great piece of light sculpture! Naturally, he knew of Mrs. Lardner's light sculpture. She was universally hailed as a genius. Yet Travis knew she could not understand even the simplest aspect of robotic mathematics. He had corresponded with her. but she consistently refused to explain her methods. And he wondered if she had any at all. Might it not be mere intuition? But even intuition might be reduced to mathematics. Finally, he managed to receive an invitation to one of her parties. He simply had to see her. Mr. Travis arrived rather late. He had made one last attempt at a piece of light sculpture, and had failed dismally. He greeted Mrs. Lardner with a kind of puzzled respect, and said, "That was a peculiar robot who took my hat and coat."
"That is Max," said Mrs. Lardner.
"He is quite maladjusted, and he's a fairly old model. How is it you did not return it to the factory?"
"Oh, no," said Mrs. Lardner. "It would be too much trouble."
"None at all, Mrs. Lardner," said Travis. "You would be surprised how simple a task it was. Since I am with U.S. Robots, I took the liberty of adjusting him myself. It took no time, and you'll find he is now in perfect working order." A queer change came over Mrs. Lardner's face. Fury found a place on it for the first time in her gentle life, and it was as though the lines did not know how to form.
"You adjusted him?" she shrieked. "But it was he who created my light sculptures. It was the maladjustment, which you can never restore, that...
It was really unfortunate that she had been showing her collection at the time, and that the jewel dagger from Cambodia was on the marble tabletop before her. Travis's face was also distorted.
"You mean, if I had studied his uniquely maladjusted positronic brain paths, I might have learned..."
She lunged with a knife too quickly for anyone to stop her, and he did not try to dodge. Some said he came to meet it, as though he wanted to die.
William Roberts was reading Gimmicks 3 and Light Verse by Isaac Asimov. The producer was Gemma Jenkins.